What city was Abraham from? What? That covers all. That covers the whole area. Who said? Who? Babylon? Okay. So you don't think it was the... Yes. Northern Mesopotamia. Okay. All right. Iran. Okay. Yes, done. The Chaldeans? Why would you say the Chaldeans or Babylonia or Upper Mesopotamia? Why Northern Mesopotamia? Why would you say that? Because what? The Fertile Crescent. But what city was Abraham from? What? Ur of the, or the way I say it, Ur of the Chaldees. And so that's where he grew up. That's where he lived until God called him. Now, you know, sometimes people think that he reflected the culture of Canaan, which he didn't. He reflected the place that he grew up, and that place was influential in the way that he conducted himself, in the way that he handled things. Let's go to Genesis chapter 11, verse 31. Genesis chapter 11, verse 31. It says, "And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abraham's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there." So, interestingly, as they, Terah took his son Abram and Lot, and they all left Ur of the Chaldees, and they were going to the land of Canaan. And is what it said, to go to the land of Canaan. So they were all on the road to go to the land of Canaan. But Terah changed his mind, and he did not go on and complete the journey. And Abram had begun to live there and take up residence in Haran, and he probably would have stayed in Haran. But God called him and said, "No, this isn't the end point. You need to continue on your journey and go to the land of Canaan." So Terah never left. He ended up dying in Haran. And God spoke to Abraham in chapter 12 and told him to leave Haran and get out of your country, from your kindred and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make you great. So God continued to indicate to Abraham where he should go, that he needed to continue the journey. You might want to notice in passing that Abraham had been living with his father until he left to go to Canaan. And when he left to go to Canaan, he was 75 years old. If Abraham was his own man, why didn't he just leave his father and go on to Canaan? It has to do with the patriarchal system in place, why he didn't do that, you know, why he stayed there. So, as we see what unfolds with Abraham's life, Abraham was not a native of Canaan. He was a native of Ur of the Chaldees, and he grew up, and there were certain ways that he lived that were common to that world. Just like we've grown up in certain places, and as a result of where we've grown up, then we tend to live our lives with our culture that we grew up with influencing us. For instance, I grew up in California for the most of my life. Just as an example here, Mrs. Jostant grew up in Louisiana. So foods that are common to Mrs. Jostant are gumbo and those jambalaya. That kind of thing was more common in that part of the world. Now maybe she's laughing and those aren't common foods. But anyway, there were certain foods she was used to. I was used to certain foods based upon where I was, my parents were from, which was the Carolinas. So they liked things like salt pork. They liked, iced tea, those kinds of things that were common. My wife was from Canada. She didn't know anything about iced tea. What are you talking about? Iced tea, hot tea, not iced tea. But she adjusted as we got married. And that's the way we tend to come from certain places, and there are certain things that are common. You know, there are people that have grown up near White Castle, and they find them to be a tasty treat. Other people that venture to a White Castle as they're older find them to be, wow, that's tough. So anyway, it's not quite as pleasant as somebody that maybe grew up on them. So Abraham was not a Canaanite. He came from another place, and he was a creature of another culture. And we are all creatures of our culture to a certain extent. We have to shed whatever culture we've come out of and adopt God's culture, because God's culture is universal, and whatever culture we were involved in the past that doesn't fit with God's culture, we have to get rid of that. So there are things that Abraham did, and the reason that he did them was because his culture was still influencing them. And we'll look at some of those. And one of the things that, one of the benefits of looking at this particular material is that people doubted whether the patriarchs were genuine. And they looked at the patriarchs and they saw what transpired in those chapters that deal with the patriarchs, and they doubted that this was authentic at all. In the 19th century, they came to see that the patriarchal portions of the Bible were not accurate at all. It was just someone's fantasy. And but as time has gone on, they felt that these things were written probably in the 10th century, in the 900s BC at the earliest, and people transferred their particular way of doing things back on these people that lived in the patriarchal period. But what's happened is they've gone through and looked at what took place here. They found evidence that these people actually existed, and what they did fit with the time. It fit with the time. And the customs that we see in practice here were not from the 10th century, but they were common to the time around the 1800 BC. So let's look at some of these things here. They've looked at things more accurately and seen that really those things that we find them practicing in Abraham's time were actually the way things were. So scholars have changed their minds about some of the controversies of the 19th century. So the first question we're going to answer, second question on your list, is this. Why did Abraham and Sarah agree to have a child by Hagar? Now, living in 20th century America or 21st century America, we would see that as, are you kidding? Now, maybe with how liberal things are today, that might not be such a surprise. But people for generations would have seen, why would they do something that outrageous? Let's go to Genesis chapter 16, and we'll look at verses 1 and 2. Genesis 16, verses 1 and 2. It says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So as you look at this, this woman has not been able to have children. And for women living at that time, that was a very serious issue. I think for women living today, it's still a serious issue, maybe with not the same pressure. But, you know, you see the woman in a movie stomping her feet saying that her biological clock is running. And that sometimes is an issue with different people. I'm getting old and my chances of having children is diminishing. I need to get married and get on with this. But Sarai did not have a child and was barren. So why did Sarah give Hagar to Abraham? Why did she do that? And why do you think Sarah gave her handmaid to Abraham? What was the mindset? Yes. Okay, but was this something Abraham was worried about it, as we'll see, but who made the decision here? No, Sarah made the decision. Sarah made the decision to give her handmaid to Abraham. So she was the one that initiated this and pursued this solution. Abraham, of course, went along with that. It's not that Abraham could have a child. That's not the reason that this was done. Sarah was not to, yes. Sure, it's a lack of faith, but basically Sarah is not telling Abraham to take her slave so that he might have a child by her. She's telling Abraham to take her maid, and perhaps by having sexual relations, she would have a child by Hagar. That's the point. It's going to be she has not been able to bear a child, and then she would have a child by Hagar. So. Why we might ask, why does she put it this way? You go back to Genesis chapter 30, keep your finger there in Genesis 16, but we see this similar statement. Genesis chapter 30, Rachel finds herself in the same situation. Leah is bearing children to Jacob. Genesis chapter 30 and verse 3. It says, "So she said, 'Here is my maid Bilhah, go into her, and she will bear a child on my knees, that I also may have children by her.'" So she gives her maid Bilhah to Jacob, and by looking at this particular verse, we can better understand what was taking place with Abraham and Sarah. And if you go back and you look at some things about archaeology, you can find a figure that's been molded, and it's a woman, and she's there waiting for a child to be born. And that's a portrayal of what's unfolding here. The midwife crouched down in front of the woman to help deliver the child. And there's also a woman behind the midwife. And it was not unusual, since the person behind would give comfort and support. But we've learned through evidence, archaeological and documentary evidence from that time, that when a woman was barren and she gave a surrogate to her husband, that the barren woman would be the one supporting the woman who was bearing the child. So she was involved in the process. So literally, the child is, so to speak, born on the one barren mistress's knees. The child would be, in essence, born on her knees. That's why it speaks of that in Genesis chapter 30. You know, that I also may have a child by her, a child on my knees. So that's an allusion to what was taking place in that time. So this was a common practice in Abraham's time. And this is what Sarah was referring to when she said that I may obtain children by her. Sarah would be regarded by the culture as the real mother. So they were, as I said, they were captives of their particular culture. And this is what was commonly done in the culture of Ur of the Chaldees. And this is what played out in their lives. That's what they decided to do. This is the solution to the problem. We will do it. And they came up with their own solution to it. So, so in this culture, we know something else about this practice. And that is, it might appear that Sarah was expressing tremendous love for her husband, especially when she realized how badly Abraham wanted a son and heir. She was willing to do something that might have been personally obnoxious, to have another woman bear a child for her husband. Yet she swallowed her discomfort because she loved her husband so much. That might be one way of looking at it, but that's not the case at all. Because in the culture of Abraham and Sarah, this was what would have been expected by a barren wife. So if you did not have a child, this was the solution. You would give your handmaid to your husband and have a child through the handmaid. And there was a strong, she didn't have to do it, but there was a strong expectation that she would do it. So that explains why Abram, though he seems to have spoken often with God and long with God in prayer on a frequent basis, didn't think it important enough to take this matter to God and ask his opinion about it. He walked with God. But he never seems to have brought the matter up to God. He just looked at, well, this is the normal thing in our society, and did what was normal. The surrogate mother remained in the household with a very high status. That's the way it was commonly done. And this is probably the reason why the text says it bothered Abraham, not just because of his son, but because of the bondwoman. He knew what his social obligations were, and he knew that Sarah had asked of him something that was not, that as this goes on, you see that there's all this conflict there. And go back to Genesis 16, verse 5. She makes a request of him that would have been very difficult. Verse 5. Then Sarai said to Abram, "My wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me." So, now, we wouldn't be surprised by this. You know, if the mother is a surrogate and has the child, that mother's going to be attached to that child, and you're setting yourself up for conflict, which is exactly what took place here. And because I'm not sure every woman who has a child, a surrogate child, is just going to say, "Yeah, go ahead and take the child, and I'll bow out." I'd say that's hard to do, because probably she was the nursing mother, so who's going to be drawn close to the child? And if you carry a child 9 months in your womb, you're just going to give that child up? Most people aren't. They're attached to that baby and going to be attached to that baby. And unfortunately, the circumstance was that, you know, Hagar says, "I've had a baby, you haven't, loser," and you've got this conflict going. And there was disrespect based from Hagar and also from Ishmael later on with Isaac. So there were problems. And, when she asked, she's talking to him here about sending her away, this was something that was not respectable for a man to do at that time. And he was upset by the treatment that Sarah got from Hagar, upset by the treatment that Isaac got from Ishmael. And she was found and determined this lady had to go because of the conflict. And wanted her husband to do something about it. And Abraham knew this wasn't right. And you know what he probably would have done if it would have been his decision alone? He wouldn't have sent Hagar away with the child. He wouldn't have done that. It would have been wrong from a cultural perspective. He would have kept the child. And kept, he had eventually Isaac, but he would have kept the child. But God intervened and said, "No, it's the right thing for the surrogate mother and the child to leave. It's the thing that was best for the family and for what God was going to work out." And so they sent them away. According to that society, if Sarah had never borne a child, then Ishmael was the sole heir to everything. But once Sarah bears a child, Ishmael is not disinherited. The custom was he had to share equally with Isaac. And the custom was strictly controlled. It wasn't just a matter of lust being satisfied. If a woman chose to use this route, then the woman and her child had rights and status that could not be just cast aside casually. And that's why Sarah makes the point. She doesn't say, "I want you to consider the possibility that you might leave something to Ishmael as well as Isaac." She says she will not have Ishmael inherit with her son. And she just takes it as a given that he will. And so because God intervened, Abraham did as Sarah had requested. He wouldn't have otherwise. Just Genesis chapter 21, verse 14. Genesis chapter 21, verse 14. "So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water. Putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba." So as you look at that, that's kind of, here we are in the desert and you're keep booting this lady out and you don't give her much. Why is that all that Abraham gave her as she set off on her way? Is it that he's tight? He's not going to give her anything? Why didn't he give her more? Or, you know, as you look at this, Abraham, we know, is a righteous man, and he was sending her away because it was God's instruction. So he could therefore rely on God to provide. He trusted that God would provide for Hagar as he sent her away. Let's look at verses 15 through 17 in Genesis chapter 21. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. Then she went and sat down across from him at a distance about a bow shot, for she said to herself, "Let me not see the death of my boy." So she sat opposite him and lifted her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, "What ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for the Lord has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold up him with your hand, and I will make him a great nation." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So God watched out for her. That's why he sent her away with so little, because Abraham knew that God was going to take care of her, that there was a separation taking place. And Abraham really didn't want to do this, but this was God's intention. And you never would have gotten to this point if they had not been captives of their culture and applied their cultural values to the circumstance they're in. And we have to look at, in our, you know, the lesson here for all of us is, we have certain cultural things that we do. This is the standard operating system based upon our culture. And you have to look at, if you're in a circumstance where you have to make a tough decision like this, and yes, this is culturally acceptable, you have to ask yourself, what would the Bible instruct me to do? And not just go with what the culture says to do, because trust me, the culture is most often, you know, many times not right. And you have to make a decision based on what's right and based upon the Bible as you make a decision. So before Abraham, the third question we move on to here, before Abraham before Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham, who would have inherited all of Abraham's property if he had no heir? You answer, anybody else? I'll take a shot at that, okay? Steve? Eliezer, right. Eliezer would have been the one who had inherited everything. So he was the one who was in line to inherit everything that Abraham owned. So, in our society, who would have inherited? If Abraham died, who would have received the inheritance in our society? Sarah would have. Sarah would have inherited that. In that society, wives and women in general didn't inherit. It would also not be Lot. Even though Lot is a relative, he was more distant than Eliezer in the way that inheritances were distributed. So the closest kin to Abraham in Canaan is his slave Eliezer. He's not blood kin. He was a slave, and he was eligible to be an heir because that's the way the society looked at it. That's how they sorted this out. A slave could be an heir if he had been born in the household. So if he was born in the household, then he was eligible to be inherit, and he was considered closer kin than a brother or a cousin or somebody like that. This was the way that they sorted things out when it came to inheritances, and it's reflected in the text. Let's go to Genesis chapter 15 and look at verse 2. Genesis 15, verse 2. It says, "Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" So this man is the one who is my heir. You've promised me an heir. You've not given me one yet. nobody's been born in my household that will be my heir. Verse 3, then Abraham said, look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, this one born in my house is my heir. So he was born in Abraham's house, and therefore he was eligible to be Abraham's heir. Documents from Mesopotamia emphasize that the child as head of the house cannot choose any old slave of the household. He could only select one that had been born in his household. He might have many slaves, but the one that he had to choose, who would be the heir, would be the one who was born. Would be one who was born in his house. More than just wealth that gets passed on to the heir, also is passed on responsibility. Eliezer had proven himself to be responsible in Abraham's house, and was elevated to being the chief steward. You know, Abraham gave him great responsibility. You're going to send just anybody to pick the person that's going to marry your son? You're going to pick somebody that you have confidence in, somebody that has wisdom, somebody that you can trust. So once again, we find another practice that's very clearly part of Abraham's time, and has been part of the time period and the culture. And that practice is that a slave born in the household could inherit from a person who was childless. It's interesting that once Abraham fathered a child, whether through a surrogate, Ishmael, or his own mother, once that takes place, Eliezer is no longer the heir. So Eliezer would have, at that point, passed from being an heir. And Eliezer was apparently a very fine individual, because even after the blood heirs were born, Abraham entrusts him with finding a wife for his son. And you don't see any resentment from him. Wow, I had the big inheritance coming and now I have nothing. I'm just another servant in the household of Abraham. You don't see that. He was a very faithful servant and sent on a complicated mission. And studying Eliezer's behavior, we see a man who prayed to God for the help needed. Obviously, he had learned about God in Abraham's household. So Abraham was attendant to teaching his household the values that he had come to understand and believe in. And he was a teacher and shared the truth with his household. And Eliezer is, as I said, is a person of character. He was doing his master's bidding as he went forward and found a wife for Isaac. So as we move on to the next question, which is number 4, with whom did Eliezer discuss finding a wife for Isaac? With whom did Eliezer discuss finding a wife for Isaac? Now, if you were going to marry a young lady in our time, and you were actually going to ask somebody about it, who would you talk to? You talk to the father. That's what would happen in our society. And you would not talk to, you know, the girl that you're pursuing, you would not talk to any other member of her family. The father's the one who's going to give the approval of this or not. But that's our culture and our way of doing things. It wasn't the way things were done back in Abraham's time. Let's go to Genesis chapter 24. Genesis chapter 24. And here we see Eliezer going to find a bride for Isaac. Genesis chapter 24 and verse 24. So she said to him, I am the daughter. So here's Eliezer. He gets to the area of Haran, the area where Abraham had dwelt before and their family was still residing. And he comes up there and he's sitting there and he's asking God that he would mercifully help him to find a suitable wife for Isaac. And so in verse 24 it says, so she said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, Milcah's son, whom she bore to Nahor. So That's an important statement. Moreover, she said, we have both straw and feed enough and room to lodge. Then the man bowed down his head and worshipped God, worshipped the Lord. He said, blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth toward my master. As for me, being on the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren. So God was very much involved here. He recognized this because he shows up in the area, and there he is. He meets one of the daughters of the family. And he goes to God and thanks him for it. So obviously, he was acquainted with God and knew God and worshiped the true God. Verse 28. So the young woman ran and told her mother's household these things. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban, and Laban ran out to the man by the well. So it came to pass when he saw the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrist, and when he heard the words of his sister Rebekah saying, thus the man spoke to me, that he went to the man, and there he stood by the camels at the well. Then the man came to the house, and he unloaded the camels and provided straw and feed for the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. So who does Eliezer discuss the proposition with? Laban? So that would be unusual for us. You know, most of us did not ask our wife's brother if we could marry her. We ask the dad. That's the standard procedure in our society. Genesis 24, verse 50. It says, then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing comes from the Lord. We cannot speak to you either good or bad. So it says Laban and Bethuel answered, it seems like there's a certain incongruity here. Who is the father of the house? It's Bethuel. And Laban is his son, Rebekah's brother, and yet Scripture gives precedence to Laban. And look at in verse 50, who's mentioned first? Who's mentioned first in verse 50? It says that then Laban and Bethuel. Laban is mentioned first because he's the most important character. And something interesting here, if they agreed to the match that Rebekah is going to marry Isaac, did Rebekah have any say-so in the matter? Yeah, she could say yes or no. She didn't have to go. So she had a choice whether she would go or not. I know all of the young ladies would gladly go with this group of people that have come from hundreds of miles away and said, my master's son would like to marry you. And you would all say, absolutely, put me on the camel and let's go. You've never seen this guy. You don't know anything about him. Would you do it? You'd say that'd be an act of faith, you know. So Rebekah was willing to do it. She proves willing to go. Let's go down to verse 53. Verse 53. Then the servant brought out jewelry of silver, jewelry of gold, and clothing, and gave to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. So Bethuel, what did he get? Nothing. He got nothing out of this deal, except he had one less daughter, says to support. But anyway, he didn't get anything out of it. The gifts are given to Rebekah and to her mother and to Rebekah's brother, because he is the one who is negotiating the marriage contract with Eliezer. So the brother is the one who worked all of this out. And so scholars looked at this and they couldn't figure this out for a long time. It just didn't seem right to them based upon what they knew. But the social customs of Upper Mesopotamia, the area from which Abraham came, dictated that it was the brother's responsibility to negotiate the marriage of the sister. He was the active party. He cast the deciding vote. He's the important person in the situation, not the father. So this was the way it was in Abraham's time here, about 1800 BC. But as you go forward in Israel, this is very different from Israelite practice and the laws and judgments that God established. You know, as we look at the laws that were given in the books of Moses, it's the father who makes these decisions, not the brother. But back in the patriarchal period, we see a different practice was followed. And once again, the Bible is describing something authentic for that earlier age. And it's not later practices thrown backward, because those practices in Israel were different. And we're going to see in a number of places that certain things are openly admitted about the patriarchs would have been illegal in Israel by God's own legislation. So those later practices could never have been written back into the lives of the patriarchs artificially. So the practices we see there brought out in the scriptures are authentic. That's the way it was back at that time. And Moses, as he wrote the book of Genesis, is reflecting that. Now, let's look at, as we've looked at these various things, let's address some questions that come up after Jacob. Jacob comes to Laban's household. So this is an interesting situation. And we'll just note these things and then we'll answer them, because they tell us various things about what's taking place. In Genesis chapter 29, verse 14, Laban says that Jacob is bone of my flesh. Why is that important? Why might Laban refer to Jacob that way? Another question that we have to ask is this: why doesn't Jacob establish his own household? Why didn't he establish his own household? Isn't that what everybody did at the time? The next point is, in discussing returning to Canaan with his wives, the question is asked in Genesis 31:14, is there still any inheritance? What inheritance was he supposed to get? What inheritance was a possibility that he had some idea that he might receive? In Genesis 30, verse 25, Rachel bears Joseph and Jacob, and then Jacob asked Laban for permission to return to his own country. He couldn't just get up and leave? Why couldn't he just get up and leave? Genesis chapter 30, verse 26, Jacob says, give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you. Weren't they his, since he had earned them? He had put in his time. Remember, he had to do 7 years for Leah, or he did 7 years for Rachel, or so he thought, then found out it was Leah he was working for, and he had to do 7 more years for Rachel. Weren't they his, once he had put in the time? We see here that these things weren't, seemed to be, you would think they were his property, but in fact that they weren't. Why does he ask Laban to give him his wives and children if they were actually his? So we see some things that, as you go through the story of Jacob and Laban, if you look at it carefully, you can see, well, that doesn't make sense. Why is it that way? And there are certain reasons it's that way, because you see a story that you may not have thought of on the surface unfolding. We know Jacob, in order to escape the pending threat from his brother Esau, he had to leave. He had to get away from his father's house, because Esau was intent on killing him, wasn't he? And why didn't Jacob just take off and head on over to Haran? Because he didn't do that. What did he do? And he asked for permission. He asked for permission to leave. Because he was under his father, Isaac, a patriarch. And that patriarchal system existed. And if you were living in the household, you could not just up and leave. So he could not leave without his father's permission. His father sent him away. He had asked for permission, and Isaac gave him permission to go. Because I think Isaac and Rebekah saw that if he remains here, there's going to be tension, and we may have a murder on our hands. Because Esau is very unhappy, and if he stays around, probably he's going to take action on that anger. So he went to his father, he made a proposal and asked his father for consent and blessing, and Isaac blessed him and sent him away. So he was able to leave. And so he goes away from Isaac and Rebekah, and he goes back to Haran, up to the area where Laban lives. And Laban is his mother's brother, his uncle. Let's go to Genesis chapter 29, verse 14. And look at one of these scriptures. Genesis chapter 29, verse 14. And Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him for a month. So, he said this for a particular reason, as we'll see. You are bone and you are my bone and my flesh. And that might, that's something that he said to him because he was a relative. He was his nephew, the son of Laban's sister. But that's what he says to him right away. Is there a reason why he would say that? Is there a reason why he might say that? So as we see the story unfold, Jacob proposes to serve Laban for 7 years. Okay, I'll serve you for 7 years in order to marry Rachel. So, it is interesting how this works out. Jacob had deceived his father, and so when he goes back to the area where his mother's brother lives, he runs into an even more effective deceiver than he was. So it's quite interesting how God works things out. You deceived your father. Well, let's see how you like it when it turns out you're the one suffering that. So anyway, he worked for Rachel. It ends up that he's with Leah, and then he has to serve 7 more years to be able to marry Rachel. But it's interesting, he stayed with Laban a long time. They think he may have stayed with him 40 years. He stayed with him a long time. But it's interesting, he stays with him all that time, but he never establishes his own household. He never establishes his own household. He always lives with Laban. He always lives with Laban. If a man is living with his father, he doesn't set up his own household in this patriarchal time period. But Laban wasn't his father. Why didn't he set up his own household? Later in Israel, a man would set up his own household, and he continues to live with his father in this period if they are both in the same area. And Laban is in charge, and Jacob continues to live with him for 40 years after marrying his daughters, and he does not set up his own household. When he marries Leah, Laban gives Jacob not a maid, which would be understandable, what one of his own personal serving maids. He does the same thing when Rachel is married to Jacob. Then we come down to the time when Jacob is told to go back to Canaan. Jacob explains what he is going to do to his wives, and they agree that Laban has not been very generous with Jacob. In fact, Laban has deceived him repeatedly, and the wives see no reason why they should stay. They have no reason to stay there. So they're not all that favored by their father. Let's go to Genesis 31, verse 14. So they're having this discussion about whether they should stay or they should go. Genesis chapter 31, verse 24. Or verse 14, not 24. Verse 30, chapter 31, verse 14. Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, "Is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house?" Why would they expect a portion or an inheritance in Laban's house? Was there ever a time when they would inherit? Was there a time when they would inherit? If so, why? You know, wives and daughters, they didn't inherit. And Jacob, he's not a son. Why would he inherit? He was not a slave born in Laban's household. So why, there's no reason why he would inherit. But it's interesting to see what they said here about the inheritance. Let's go to chapter 30, verse 25. And it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place, to my own country." He was relying upon Laban to send him away, to allow him to be able to leave. He couldn't just get up and go on his own. Why does he have to ask for permission to leave? Verse 26, it says there, "Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know my service which I have done for you." So if he worked for them, aren't they his? So probably if we're going through this, you don't really stop and think about it. Why is it stated this way? Let's go to chapter 29 and look at verse 19. Chapter 29, verse 19. It says here, "And Laban said, 'It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me.'" So the question is, is it simply because there's a virtue in marrying your daughter to a near relative, or is there something more behind Laban's words? Why marry a daughter to Jacob as opposed to a stranger? Why do that? And we come to the fact of who was doing the negotiating over the marriage of Rachel, what relationship does Laban have to Rachel? Well, he is her father, and in this period, who carries out the negotiation for marriage? It's a brother. So what does that tell you about the household of Laban? He has these two daughters, Rachel and Leah. Is there a brother? If there was a brother, he would be doing the negotiating, but he's not in the picture, as we saw earlier with Eliezer and Laban. Chapter 31, verse 2. Chapter 31, verse 2 is interesting. "And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before." So at one time, Laban was favorable to him, but at this point, Laban's no longer favorable. Why not? What changed? What changed where Laban would no longer favor Jacob? And why is that? You know, he's noticed that he's not favoring him like he did. Now, so his countenance wasn't favorable toward him, and there has to be something behind these words. Finally, Jacob does leave, and he gets the support of his wives, and so they decide to leave. But how does he leave? He's not gotten permission from Laban. He just leaves because Laban's not going to give him permission. He's the patriarch. He's got a good deal with Jacob. Why is he going to let him leave? Even though conditions are unfavorable for Jacob, and finally they say, "Look, the only way we are ever going to get out of this is to pick up and leave." And so they begin their journey, leaving Laban behind. And so he stole away, And it was unknown to Laban. And so then he follows him. And God steps in and tells Laban, look, this is something that I am endorsing. So watch yourself here. Because I think Laban was intent upon taking out vengeance on Jacob, but God stops him and says, no, you're not going to do that. You're not going to do that. So Jacob just gets up, takes up and leaves and heads off, and Laban catches up with him and they come to an agreement. Let's go to chapter 31, verse 30. Chapter 31, verse 30. Now you have surely gone because you greatly long for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Then Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live in the presence of our brethren. Identify what I have of yours and take it with you. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen his gods. So Laban makes other claims, and he makes these claims about things that had been stolen from him. Verse 43, it says, and Laban answered and said to Jacob, these daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and this flock is my flock, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have born? So, he points out, this is all mine. Everything here is mine. Legally mine. The daughters, the children, the animals, everything that they had, all the wealth of Jacob was his. That's the way it was in the patriarchal household. And so he said, it's all mine, and how dare you take my property away? And the reason is because he was the patriarch of the household. And so he goes ahead and he enters into a covenant with Jacob here, and then Jacob is able to move on. So what's taking place here that we see unfolding here that we may not see on the surface? So does anybody know what answers all the questions? We've seen these various issues. What answers all the issues? We have Leah, we have Rachel. Why does Laban act in the way that he does and in the way that he deals with Joseph, with Jacob? Yes. He was what? What? Oh, custom of the people. It was a custom in a sense, yes. But what custom? Yes. He did in a sense, but notice that when Jacob comes, you have Leah and you have Rachel, but you don't have a brother. There is no brother. That's later. In Genesis 31, it does talk about Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all of this wealth. Eventually, Laban had sons. They're younger than the girls. But when this first starts out, Laban has no heir. His heir would have been like Abraham, one of the slaves born in his household. So he has no heir. And here comes Jacob, and Jacob is looking for a wife. And he said, ah, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. They can marry you, and the inheritance is going to stay in the family. It's not going to go outside the family to a stranger. Okay? So Jacob was adopted as a son. And so he looked favorably upon him. And he did have Laban's favor. But guess what happened? When he had his own sons, sorry, you're out. Okay? And he no longer looked favorably upon Jacob. So Jacob was looked upon favorably when he first came because he was an adopted son, and he looked upon him as a son. But when he had his own flesh and blood sons, you're adopted, man. You're not, you know how it goes with adoption sometimes. You're the favored child, and then the real child comes, and then you're out. You're the second-rate son, you know, the red-headed stepchild or whatever. So you, and this was the case, Jacob was favored. But then, once he had his own sons, then Laban no longer gave him favor. And you see that he was, and Laban was the patriarch. And Jacob was an adopted son, and so he had to stay with the patriarch. He couldn't just get up and leave. And Laban had a good thing going. Why is he going to let Jacob leave? So finally, in 40 years, eventually he said, you know what? This isn't going so good. We need to leave and start our own household. So he did. And so they leave, and yes, everything is Laban's because he is the patriarch. But God is involved here, and it's time for Jacob to leave and start his own household. So the answer to all, yes. They were supermen and women, but look at the fact that Laban is, you know, think about it. When Rebekah is given to Isaac, obviously a few years have transpired, and he's the one who negotiates. He's got to have a few years on him when Jacob shows up. And if Jacob was there when he's 40, he's got to have a few more years on him. You know, he stayed with him for 40 years. They were prolific. I don't know. They didn't have all they were not as defective as we are, you know, with all the health problems we have, Mr. Schultz. That's what they think. Time necessary for what? It might have been. You never know. If you'd gone back too early, you would have killed him. Yes. I'm just telling you, that's. I said they see it as a possibility of 40 years if you start adding up all the different things. So that's not written in stone. But we know he was at least there for 14. Obviously, that says 20. But if you start adding up the different things, they think that he was there close to 40 years. It's a possibility he was there a long time. So anyway, we're going to stop there for today. And next time we'll talk about, how many of you know the answer to what was the occupation of the patriarchs? What was their main occupation? What was that? They were shepherds? Okay. We'll answer that next time. Was it shepherds or traders? And we'll see why it's one or the other. So thanks everybody for your attention. Please have a great remainder of the Sabbath.